Your order at about 8:02, committee time, did you change it yet?
Nope.
And let the record reflect that we have Co-Chair Olson, Representative Ledoux, Representative Salmon, and Representative Cisna here. And what we're going to do is listen to Ada, then we'll bring up 117. But because we are losing members, we're not going to move 117. We'll hold it over, let people know right now. So I think we have two people waiting to leave. So at that, we'll start with Ada overview. So if you come up and share with us your packets you gave us.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman.
Good morning.
Members of the committee. My name is Ron Miller, Executive Director of Alaska Industrial Development and Export Authority and Alaska Energy Authority. With me, I have Mike Harper, who's our Deputy Director for Rural Energy, and Sarah Fisher-Goad, a financial analyst. They're here to answer any questions the committee may have. If you wish, Mr. Chairman, we can start with ADA and then go into Alaska Energy Authority. And the committee members should have packets of information. We sent down PowerPoint presentations for both corporations. And earlier, committee members should have received, along with the rest of the legislature, a copy of ADA annual report 2004 and that covers statistical report on PCE program. If committee members did not receive those, let me know. We'll make sure they get copies. Starting with ADA, our mission is to provide means of financing to promote economic growth and diversification in Alaska. And we do that, we meet that mission by providing Alaska businesses with long-term commercial and development financing at a reasonable cost. We look at the state overall as our customer, but segments within that are businesses, communities throughout Alaska, and banks. Our role in economic development is twofold, providing financial assistance to Alaskan businesses and also providing a dividend to the State of Alaska General Fund. We see that as providing two types of return, an economic return in creating jobs and a financial return, direct financial return in providing a dividend. Since the start of ADA's dividend program in 1996, our board has made available over $178 million in total dividends to the state's general fund. And our financing is long-term, lower cost, we have mixed term, and we can also provide tax-exempt financing to Alaska businesses. We not only, when people think of ADA, they think ADA does just large projects, but we work on large and small projects, urban and rural projects, and throughout the whole of Alaska's industry sectors, whether it's retail, tourism, natural resource extraction and processing, air cargo, or services. People have some misperceptions about ADA. We do not compete with the private sector. Our loan programs are in participation with Alaska's commercial institutions. We do not originate loans. We do not provide grants. And as I said earlier, we do not finance only large projects. Through our various programs, we work with Alaska businesses of all sizes. We've done loan guarantees for as low as $7,500, and of course our largest investment is the DeLong Mountain Transportation System connected to the Red Dog Mine. That's about $270 million in total investment there. Our key programs are development finance, loan participation, loan guarantee and export assistance, and conduit revenue bond. Through the development finance program, our objective is to finance necessary infrastructure to support Alaska business projects. Through that program, we actually own the project and are repaid through user fees, leases, or other revenue sources. Red Dog Port and Road is an example, as is the Federal Express maintenance facility at the Anchorage International Airport. To qualify for a development finance project, we have to get a sign-off by the local government, and that project has to be financially feasible. On page 11 of your handout, we have some examples. Again, the DeLong Mountain Transportation System, FedEx facility, Alaska Seafood International, the Snettisham Hydroelectric Project, which provides electricity to Juneau, and Ketchikan Shipyard. Page 12 starts an overview of the DeLong Mountain Transportation System that was critical to the opening of that mine. That mine formed the tax basis for creation of the Northwest Arctic Borough, so you can see a direct result of some of our development finance programs there. As of last summer, the Red Dog Mine provided 510 jobs, of which approximately 57% were held by NANA shareholders. NANA is the partner with Techminco Alaska in that project. Those jobs at Red Dog represent over 30% of the private sector jobs in the NANA region. Page 13 are some pictures of the port at Red Dog. The Federal Express maintenance facility at the Anchorage Airport, that created 20 permanent high-skilled jobs and brought to Alaska a pilot base that significantly adds to the income into South Central Alaska. It also allows for an improvement of basic services for air carriers and strengthens Alaska's role as an air crossroads. Alaska Seafood International, a project that got lots of attention and was unfortunately not very successful. That's described starting on page 15. I can bring the committee up to date. We're in the process of signing a purchase sales agreement for that property with a limited liability company called Anchorage Economic Development, LLC. And that will allow a mix of uses at that facility. We were hoping that we would get a bid from someone interested in putting primary jobs in that facility, but we didn't realize that. We expect to see about 300 new jobs created from Anchorage Community Development, LLC. That will be a mix of meeting space. There will be a sports facility built behind the existing building that will allow indoor soccer and track events. The coal storage that's next to ASI is owned by Alliance Refrigeration, a company out of Wisconsin. It sits on our property. Alliance is a part of the LLC, and they are working with Cisco Foods to expand Cisco's presence in the state. So that will create additional jobs. Page 18 describes Snettisham Hydroelectric Project, approximately 28 miles southeast of Juneau, and about 80% of Juneau Douglas's electrical energy comes from that project. We have a long-term power sales agreement with AEL&P for the purchase of all electricity produced by Snettisham. The Ketchikan Shipyard is a project that we are currently working on to expand. ADA purchased title from State Department of Transportation in 1997, and we received an EDA grant to put in a second ship lift there. Construction on that project is expected to start soon. We have negotiated a long-term operating agreement with Alaska Ship and Dry Dock, and we're waiting for the completion of a long-term memorandum of understanding with the city and borough regarding some tax considerations before those documents are finalized. Probably our most active program now is our loan participation program. And because the legislature expanded that program 2 years ago, we can purchase up to 90% of a loan originated by a commercial lending institution with total participation not to exceed $20 million. In a 12-year period between 1992 and the end of FY 2004, that program created nearly 4,500 construction jobs and 4,700 permanent jobs through our loan participations. Page 24 sets out a loan portfolio diversification by industry chart. And as you can see, we're involved in most of the major segments of the Alaska economy through that program. As of December 31, 2004, our outstanding loan portfolio was $304 million. And page 25 shows what the loan portfolio delinquency is as of December 31, 2004. It's 0.44%. At the end of third quarter 2004, all Alaska banks, their delinquency rate was 2.10%. So we're well below the Alaska industry average.
Does that include, does that include the seafood?
The seafood
was already been taken out of the
Seafood was a development finance project. It was a different program than our loan participation.
Oh, okay.
We do have some, I think we have one or two fishery loans outstanding in that portfolio. One is the Alaska Glacier Seafoods here in Juneau out by the ferry terminal at Lock Bay.
You mean outstanding?
Oh, it's a current loan.
Current, okay. Under construction there. Thank you.
Though for the committee members interested in the geographic distribution of our loan portfolio, page 26 shows a breakout and the geographical classifications are, we use the same ones the State Department of Labor uses. And these areas are explained in our annual report as well. It gives a breakdown of the communities within there. Other programs we have are the Loan Guarantee and Export Assistance. We can provide a loan guarantee of up to 80% of a loan, not to exceed $1 million on the principal of a loan. We can also provide guarantees for export transactions in that same amount. We are a city-state partner with the U.S. Export-Import Bank, which means that Alaskan businesses, small businesses, can access Ex-Im Bank programs through ADA.
Okay, we have a question here from Representative Ledoux.
I just going back to page 25 where it shows that the delinquency rate is less than on commercial loans. You often take risks that commercial loans lenders won't take, and you still are able to have this pretty good delinquency ratio?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, we don't because our loans are originated by commercial bank and they're brought to us. So we have two and sometimes three levels of credit review and underwriting. The commercial institution does their underwriting first, then they bring the loan to us, and if we agree to take a look at it, we have an internal credit committee of seven staff members. And if the loan is over $3 million, that goes to our board of directors. So our risk profile is a bit lower than what commercial institutions have because we have these reviews. And again, the commercial institution will originate the loan. They wouldn't originate the loan if there was a high level of risk because they can retain from, well, a minimum of 10% of the loan themselves.
So. Can I just ask a follow-up?
Representative Ledoux, yes.
On that. When you show your delinquency ratio, are bad loans like that place that you had in Anchorage, that big seafood place, are those just written off from this?
No. Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, our bad loans would be in the over 90 days category here on a delinquency list. We write off very few loans, and again, Alaska Seafood International was not a loan. It was ADA built the building and leased it to Alaska Seafood. So it's our property. Or better or worse.
Thank you.
One program that is probably one of our quieter programs, but is evident all over the state, is our conduit revenue bond program. And the purpose of this program is where ADA can provide financing. We act as a conduit for the issuance of taxable or tax-exempt bonds. And neither the assets nor credit of ADA are at risk. The credit worthiness of the project and any credit enhancements, such as insurance or other enhancements offered by the applicant, support the underwriting and placement of the bonds. And to qualify for a conduit revenue bond, business can request adoption of an eligibility resolution from our board for tax-exempt financing. They submit a preliminary application to ADA, and if our board of directors adopts an eligibility resolution for the project, the applicant then submits an application for financing for the project. And from program inception in 1978 through the end of last year, we've issued over approximately $929 million in conduit revenue bonds for 303 projects throughout the state. And they've been a wide range of projects, from the Fort Knox Gold Mine near Fairbanks to Hope Community Resources Facility in Anchorage, Providence Health System in Anchorage, and our most recent conduit revenue bond issue was $120 million for the Fairbanks Memorial Hospital Foundation, which allows refinancing some existing debt, construction of new facilities, and expansion of existing facilities. We have started a new program within the conduit revenue bond program, trying to make the transactional documents as uniform as possible, so the cost for bond counsel aren't as high as you would have with a normal bond issue. And that will allow some of the smaller nonprofit corporations in the state to access this program for tax-exempt financing and maintain very low transactional fees. An example of that in Anchorage is APTI, the public broadcasting entity there. They purchased Alaska Public Radio Network and needed to expand the Elmo Sackett Center out near the universities so they could combine both corporations. They came to us, and I think we closed a few days ago on a $1.2 million conduit revenue bond. We worked in conjunction with Wells Fargo Bank and had very low transactional cost for APTI for that bond issue, and they were very pleased with the results. They got lower financing that would allow them to pay off some existing debt and expand facilities.
Representative Sisler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have been slowly learning more and more about, in fact, I've been a student, in economics, and am trying to understand how Alaska's local economies work. And in your report, you talk about some of the measurements that you've got for all these different loans and projects that you're working on. So you've got the percentage of Alaskan hire, and I'd love to know kind of what other information you accumulate, because that's one way of knowing how both the state is working with local communities, but also what's happening. Could you talk about what kind of maybe thumbnail, what some of the data that you might be able to accumulate or you do?
Sure. Through the chair, Representative Sisno, what we look at for any of our projects are jobs created, retained, construction and permanent category. We look at, through our loan portfolio, we maintain a close watch on our delinquency rate, which can give us an idea of what's happening throughout the state. Another criteria we look at is through our loan or development finance program, the match from the business project. We try to get a 2-to-1 match at least, where if Ada's putting up money, say, for the Federal Express facility or the Long Mountain Transportation System, we'd like to see that at least doubled by the mining company or the other business. That was more than exceeded by Tech Minco Alaska and their investment in the Red Dog Mine. Other than that, we try to maintain contact with the financial community throughout the state, all the business organizations. We are, this year, we'll probably be doing an extensive survey throughout Alaska's business community to find out what they think of current economic conditions in the state, two, what they think of ADA's programs, what they would like to see that we aren't doing. And as soon as we get that done, I will make copies available to all members of the legislature.
Yeah, wonderful. Thank you.
Follow up?
Oh, yeah. I always have a follow up. Well, then the other thing that I have in the reading that we all kind of are doing, we're hearing more and more about climate change. That the further north you go, that maybe more extreme things are happening. And I've begun asking the folks that come into my office about what part of maintenance and replacement and that kind of thing are maybe a result of the weather, the warming, the freezing, and all of those things that are really related to change in climate. And I think the rural areas are far more sensitive to this than the urban areas, but I think we should be keeping track of that information. Mm-hmm. Do you do any of that, or can you assess that?
We look at it on a project-by-project basis. We are keeping an eye on the DeLong Mountain Transportation System because we do own 52 miles of the road there. And we have constant reports on the condition of that road and maintenance requirements. We haven't seen any new developments with regard to climate change as applied to that road, but it's something we monitor constantly.
Any more questions? If not, AEA?
Mr. Chairman, you can't talk about ADA without talking about Alaska Energy Authority, simply because ADA provides staffing for AEA. AEA, like ADA, is a corporation organized under Department of Commerce for administrative purposes, and AEA's mission is to reduce the cost of energy in Alaska. AEA operates and maintains state-owned power projects. We partner with Denali Commission and the private sector to bring safe, reliable power to Alaskans, and we help train Alaskans to build and maintain code-compliant, right-sized energy systems.
Can I jump in there?
Yes, sir.
I was talking to somebody last night, and they were talking about a power plant in Galena that's nuclear, and it's being built or something right now. Are you involved in that? Are you just watching? Or
we had been approached in the past about possible involvement with that project. Our statute, AEA statute, precludes us from being involved in a nuclear power project. Just by the definition of a power project, it specifically excludes nuclear power.
So if this one's successful, somebody can change the rules on it. I mean, it sounds good. Doesn't sound like it's going to blow up or something. Representative Ledoux.
Do you know what the rationale was in that the statute specifically excluded nuclear power?
Yeah. I think it was at that time people considered nuclear power too risky for Alaskan projects, and since AEA's focus now is primarily rural with nuclear power in rural Alaska. We have kept an eye on the proposal for Galena, and like I say, we were not directly involved in that project.
Representative Salmon.
Yes. The military also has a nuclear power plant right up north of Fort Yukon, about 70 miles up Bear Mountain. So they, you know, nobody mentions that, but they're all concentrating on Galena, you know. So I mean, he's been working for them for the last, you know, 10 years, you know. You know, there has to be something with it. And I think it's a similar, you know, power plant.
Yeah, if they make it sound kind of simple, dig a hole, put the thing in the ground, you hook two wires to it. That's it. It's kind of like a battery, you know. And you glow in the dark. But
yes, sir.
Don't need headlights anymore. Anyway. Okay, it's good. You on, Ron.
Alaska Energy Authority owns the Bradley Lake Hydro Project down on Ketchmack Bay, Larsen Bay Hydro on Kodiak Island, the Alaska Intertie, which is a transmission line, runs from Willow up to Healy, Alaska. And we have some small rural interties in western Alaska. Our programs are power cost equalization. We administer that for the state in conjunction with the Regulatory Commission of Alaska. We have alternative energy and energy efficiency programs, bulk fuel loan programs, and power project loan programs. Bulk fuel upgrades and rural power system upgrades. Those two programs, the upgrades programs, are in conjunction with the Denali Commission. We also run a circuit rider, an emergency response program, and an active training program. We try to work with Alaska communities to lower their consumer power costs, assist in developing safe, reliable, and efficient energy systems, and build sustainable and environmentally sound power systems throughout Alaska.
We have a question there. Representative Salmon.
Yes, Chairman. I guess the President is cutting the budget, and I guess a lot of this, like Denali Commission, is going to be cut. How does that affect your program?
Well, we're monitoring that quite closely. If they reduce the amount of money to the Denali Commission, that will reduce the number of projects we can do in any given fiscal year, particularly with rural power system upgrades and bulk fuel tank farm projects. PCE, our power cost equalization, provides financial assistance to rural utilities with kilowatt hour rates greater than 12 cents. Residential customers are eligible for a PCE credit up to 500 kilowatts per month per customer. Community facilities as a group can receive PCE credit for up to 70 kilowatt hours per month, multiplied by the number of residents in a community.
I have a question on that for me. My understanding is that you have X number of dollars, it's 100 million or whatever. Who manages that? Is that left in the permanent fund, or is that just kind of like a money that's laying on the side in theory and nobody manages it at all? Or how does that work?
Mr. Chairman, the PCE endowment is managed by the Department of Revenue, and it's a separate account from the permanent fund.
Do they do as well as the permanent fund, or do they do better in the investment?
Well, ask Sarah Fisher Goad to join me at the table. The PCE statute provides very strict parameter for them as far as return that they are to aim for. The program assumes a 7% return to the endowment, and that, I think, has been problematic in the past. Sarah?
PCE endowment was set up to be invested.
She can't hear you.
The PCE endowment was set up to be invested to earn 7% over time. There is a investment policy that the Department of Revenue uses, and it does include equity investments. That's probably about the only thing that would produce 7% over time. The endowment is relatively new and actually was originally created in about year 2000. In the first couple of years, there were some losses similar to what anybody saw in any investments that they had at the same time. The last couple of years has not been too bad. And right now, they are earning 7% over time, at least in FY05, investments have been fairly good.
How do they rate with the permanent fund, which one is, do you know which one does better, or?
I'll have to get back to you on that. Like I said, I know right now they're meeting, for FY05, the fund is earning what is expected statutorily to earn 7%. I'm not certain what, in the same time period, what the permanent fund is earning.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chairman, page 9 of your AEA PowerPoint presentation sets out some of the basics on that endowment, the amount, how it was capitalized. Through AEA's alternative energy programs, we focus on small hydroelectric projects, wind, geothermal, bioenergy. We also participate in the Rebuild America Conservation Program and Energy Cost Reduction Program. That's where we get assistance through the U.S. Department of Energy. We have two loan programs at AEA. One is the Bulk Fuel Revolving Loan Fund. That fund provides short-term, low-interest loans that allows rural communities with a population of less than 2,000 to make bulk fuel purchases in a cost-effective manner. The first loan a community gets under that program is 0%. After that, the loans are 5% per annum for that community.
If I may just ask a question here. For some reason, I've heard complaints that either the loan wasn't out in time to buy fuel last year, or you know what I'm, or the price went up before they could buy it. Something about shortfall of money or something that you know.
Well, we're pretty, people that run this program, they work very hard to get loans out in time to allow purchases. I think problems that we saw last year where the loans were made, a couple of communities didn't provide the down payment that they were supposed to provide, which is a 10% down. There was a low water situation in some of the villages where they just couldn't get deliveries. We had the loan commitment, they just okay. couldn't get delivery of the fuel barge. And others waited to late in the year, and the price of the fuel had increased significantly, and they had originally thought that they could borrow X amount, then they realized they needed to borrow X plus 40%. And couldn't go forward with a loan. Okay. But our credit department works, they do work very hard to get the loans out in time, because we know that there are some communities you get two deliveries only over a summer and early fall period.
Okay, thank you.
Our power project fund provide loans to local utilities, local governments, or independent power producers for development or upgrade of electric power facilities, including conservation, bulk fuel storage, waste energy conservation, or potable water supply projects. One of our active...
Oh, we have a question.
What kind of shape are your receivables in on both those loan programs?
They're in pretty good shape. I can get you our delinquency rates for both of those.
Yeah, if you could just email them to me, that'd be fine.
Okay.
Okay.
One of our Denali Commission partnership programs is bulk fuel upgrades. Participants are utilities, schools, governments, and private sector. We rehab or construct new bulk fuel tank farms to meet state and federal codes, and we also improve storage capacity needed for bulk delivery of fuel. Page 13 is a before and after set of photos from Pedro Bay. Shows what the existing tank farm looked like, and then in partnership with the Denali Commission and the community, we built a code compliant facility there. The picture in the lower right hand corner shows that. The pictures of the in the lower left hand corner, these are local residents that we hired on the project, and that's one of our goals, is to have as much local hire for these projects as possible. And rural power system upgrade program, again, through Denali Commission, we rebuild or replace worn-out diesel generator units and old hazardous distribution systems. We construct new generation systems to meet federal and state codes, and wherever possible, include waste heat recovery. our circuit rider and emergency response program. We assist village electric utilities with preventive maintenance, on-site operator training, consultation, technical assistance, and emergency response. In conjunction with Avtec and Seward and other partners, we have very active training programs for bulk fuel operators, itinerant bulk fuel operators, spill response training, utility clerks, advanced power plant operators, and small hydroelectric projects. On page 17 shows some of our training classes. To assist communities with the PCE program, we have a very active program for training PCE clerks, and I think to date we've trained over 120 PCE clerks throughout rural Alaska. We are working on a distance delivery for that training program where we can do it either online or with CD, send that out to the communities and then contact them through a computer hookup and try to run training programs that way. AEA-owned energy assets, as I said before, include Bradley Lake Hydroelectric Project, the Alaska Intertie, and Larson Bay Hydro Project.
I have a question on that. Wasn't Bradley Lake funded by the legislature, and then they turned it over to you, or how did you end up inheriting that?
It was funded in part by state appropriation and then bonds that were issued. And the utilities, the rail belt utilities, have a long-term power sales agreement with AEA, and they, in fact, are paying $12 million a year, which goes to the debt service on the bonds.
And that provides power to?
To the rail belt. It serves from Homer to Fairbanks as well as Delta Junction area.
It does make it to Fairbanks? What's the power rate there? I heard it's like 6 cents or something.
I think it's 6 cents. The power sales agreement is about 6 cents per
kilowatt.
I can get that information for you, Representative Thomas.
Well, the question was, if you know, kind of ties to PCE for history of some people. The reason they have PCE is because they built these dams, and I don't know if you. The word is felt guilty because they got 6 cents a kilowatt, and we're paying in my district as high as 53 cents. So they put a little thing in there called PCE. And just a comment is that some people say, how do you fund PCE? I always told them, put two more cents on this thing here and fund PCE up to the level that it needs. And then, I mean, if you're getting a subsidy, where I live, I'm paying 14 cents, and that's cheap for a rural area. We have the power people in town this week, and it varies from 34 cents to 53 right now. And even with PCE, there's no way that you don't even get close to, you don't even get to sniff 6 cents. I mean, that's...
6 cents is the wholesale rate to the utilities from the Bradley Lake project, and then whatever they add on before they arrive at their retail rate is...
But they don't reach anywhere close to 50 cents.
No.
That's my point.
I think there would be an uproar in the rail belt if it got that high.
Well, but I mean, it still was public funds, is the question, I guess. Representative Salmon.
I thought that was a good point to bring out, you know, because every time they people in the Capitol here, you know, bring up PCE, they act like they're giving us money, you know, and they don't realize what, you know, the other funding that the state provides for, like the four dams. I think there's four dams, one Juneau, Larson Bay, and there's Bradley, and there's one more. I don't know where the other one's at, but.
Through the chair, Representative Salmon, the four dam pool project doesn't include Bradley or Snettisham. Those were dams, I think it was Kodiak, Southeast Alaska, at Copper Valley. Those were the communities that were included in the Four Dam Pool Power Project and are members of the Four Dam Pool Agency. But those were, Representative Salmon, through the chair, those were projects were built with state and federal and sold to the Four Dam Pool Agency. And that the sale of those assets created the basis for the PCE endowment. that sales price plus some state appropriations.
Right.
Larson Bay Hydro, page 20, is a small 475-kilowatt project. Went into commercial operation in mid-1991 and then produces electricity for that Cadillac Island community. The project also replaced the city of Larson Bay's old water system and provides, the whole project provides a better source of water and improved electrical reliability. The city of Larson Bay operates the project. The Alaska Intertie, which is owned by AEA on behalf of the state, it's a 170-mile-long transmission line from Willow to Healy, and it connects the power distribution systems of Anchorage and Fairbanks. The goal of that project was to provide greatest public benefit to further the intended purposes of the Alaska Intertie, improving reliability and economic energy delivery to the rail belt. That intertie was built with $124 million. That's in 1985 money in state appropriations, and allows Fairbanks to purchase lower-cost electricity produced with natural gas and hydroelectric power from South Central Alaska.
If I can jump in, why was I under the impression they burned coal to generate electricity? Are they used to, or still do, or what? I thought there was a...
Representative Thomas, Golden Valley has a coal-powered plant at Healy. It's a 25-megawatt plant, but they also buy substantial electricity from... Of course, they are part of the Bradley Lake project. They get electricity from that, and they buy electricity from Chugach Electric and MLMP in the Anchorage area. And that's bussed up the Alaska Intertie to Healy and then on up to Fairbanks.
Okay. Thank you.
A couple of years ago, the Alaska legislature appropriated $20.3 million to Alaska Energy Authority to extend and upgrade the Alaska Intertie to the Thielen substation in the Matsu Valley. And with that, Mr. Chairman, I'm glad to take any more questions the committee has on AEA or ADA.
Tear it up, Woody. Are you leaving? Have a good trip. Any questions? If not, hey, I like that. Learn something new every day, see?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, thank
and
you.
And we'll get the answers to your questions to the committee here shortly.
Okay, thank you.
Could I ask for a brief at ease?
Sure.
Thanks.
We're at ease. At this time, and I thank you, Ada, Ron.
Thanks again.
Sarah, thanks for coming down. Hopefully that wasn't the only reason to come to town. But
it's always a pleasure to see the legislature.
Okay. Good answer. At this time, we're going to bring up House Bill 117. As we said earlier, we are losing members, so we probably won't move it, but at least we'll hear it. And is there anybody here to present the bill? No, I was going to say, if not, we'll go home.
Mr. Chairman,
state your name and...
I'm Chris Kennedy. I'm from the Department of Law. I'm filling in for Craig Tillery, who is unable to be here today. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, HB 117 addresses a problem that the legislature has addressed two or three times in the past. As members know, winning litigants in civil lawsuits in Alaska receive a partial recovery, normally, of their attorney's fees at the end of the case. And Alaska is unique in that way. We're the only state that has what's called the English rule, in which if you lose a case, you pay part of the other side's attorney's fees. And normally, the attorney's fees that are paid are either 20% of a money judgment or less, or else if it's not a money judgment case, you end up paying 20 to 30% of the actual attorney's fees that were reasonably incurred by the other side. What HB 117 addresses is a special circumstance where Alaska goes even beyond that partial recovery and in in the last two or three decades, the courts have been awarding an enhanced fee, full fee recovery to a certain class of litigants. And those are the parties that the court has determined are public interest litigants. And they are people who are advancing causes that the court determines subjectively are in pursuit of strong public policies. Over the last 10 years, that the amount paid out in extra fees under this enhanced attorney fees policy has been averaging about $600,000 a year, and it, that is, and I'm just talking in broad numbers. In a typical year, we'll pay about $800,000 to $900,000 in attorney's fees in public interest litigant cases. But the extra amount, the amount that's beyond the 20 or 30% that we would normally have to pay, is about $600,000. The Supreme Court created this public interest litigant doctrine. Over time, it began in the 1970s, and it was expanded significantly in the late 1990s. And they are very frank that it's a policy choice. They've done it under the legislative delegation of attorneys' fees authority to the Supreme Court that goes back to 1962 and actually into territorial days. But they feel that it advances public policy to provide this subsidy to certain kinds of litigation. It's as it's developed, the public interest litigant doctrine permits parties to recover their full attorney's fees from the state or municipality even when they don't prevail on very many of the claims that they bring. A good example of that is the 1999 case, American Civil Liberties Union versus state, which related to the 1996 campaign finance reform law. And the Department of Law feels it successfully defended that law in most respects. We won. We were able to preserve most of its provisions. But and the ACLU, I believe, agreed with us because they attempted to take the case up another step to the U.S. Supreme Court to get the judgment in Alaska reversed. But nonetheless, because they had succeeded in knocking out two provisions of the campaign finance bill, they were able to recover all of their fees for the entire challenge, which was $131,000. And you know, whether that's good or bad, that's just an example of how this doctrine now works. HB 117 creates a new provision in Chapter 9, and Title 9, that's in the chapter that's devoted to immunities, and it puts a cap on attorneys' fees awards against governments in the state. That's very similar. It's actually at the upper end of the partial awards that are normally awarded to winning litigants in Alaska, so there wouldn't be the enhanced awards available. It provides, as a matter of sovereign immunity, that for civil actions or appeals in which a money judgment is recovered, the state and municipalities wouldn't be liable to pay more than 20% of the amount of the money judgment as an attorney's fees to the other side. Now, that would very rarely come into play because that particular cap, because it's unusual to get enhanced attorney's fees in a money case. But then HB 117 goes on and places a cap in civil actions where there's no money judgment. If a case like that, and this would be a case about a regulatory decision, for example, if a case like that goes to trial, the attorney's fee award to the other side would be capped at 30% of that party's reasonable actual attorney's fees. If the case didn't go to trial, the award would be capped at 20% of the party's reasonable attorney's fees. And the same kind of limit would be in place for appeals. There would be a 20% cap on the amount of the other side's attorney's fees that the state or municipality would have to pay. When I talk about appeals, that would typically be the appeal to the Superior Court of a decision made by an agency. These limitations do not apply, or would not apply, where statutes provide differently. They wouldn't apply where the court had determined that there needed to be an enhanced attorney's fees as a sanction. If, for example, if there had been some kind of misconduct by the state or the municipality or by, more commonly, by their attorneys. And the limitation wouldn't apply in cases relating to eminent domain. So if the state conducts a taking on someone's property and is determined to have offered too little money as compensation, we would not only pay the compensation, but the amount that was required by that person to establish what the compensation should be. This immunity is, there are really two main rationales for it. One is to protect the state and municipal treasuries. It is a money-saving measure. Equally important, it's to return to the legislature the authority to make the policy choices regarding what kinds of litigation to subsidize, because the Supreme Court policy is frankly a subsidy. The immunity can be waived by a specific statute, and as some members may recall, the legislature enacted HB 145, as it's commonly called, 2 years ago, which created a kind of special fee treatment for constitutional cases. That act has been under attack in the courts and is now up before the Alaska Supreme Court. But if it should be upheld by the Alaska Supreme Court, then it would become one of the exceptions to HB 117, and the caps would be removed for those kind of cases. That's the end of my prepared testimony. If the committee has any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
I just have one on the fiscal note. I always thought if there was a positive thing that they would have brackets. I mean, if you were to save $600,000 a year, it seemed like there would be brackets with $600,000, meaning there's potential savings. Am I wrong?
Would it be noted somewhere indeterminate?
I'm not an expert on fiscal notes, but maybe we should revise that.
Because I see it says zero.
It could
and
be.
It seemed to me that, you know, if one was worried about saving the general the coffers, that it would show that it would be a savings to the state of $600,000 that you were saying in your presentation.
It could be that $600,000, of course, wouldn't be a savings to the Department of Law. It's, you know, these cases are against all manner of state agencies.
We'll find out.
Yeah, but we'll.
Why it's not like. Go ahead.
The legal awards like that are generally a special appropriation.
Oh, okay. Do you hear that? It's usually an appropriation, not part of the budget.
They generally put those in supplemental.
Okay, yeah.
Okay. Yeah, I think that's true.
That makes sense then. Any questions? Like I said, we're going to hold this over because we're losing membership, so. Representative Sisna.
Well, I guess I just want to make, I don't know if this is a question, but I think it's more of a statement, and that is that I guess... on the face of this, and I'm continuing my, as I mentioned to you, my looking at the balance issue and the fact that we talk about accountability a lot around here, and I think part of who needs to be held accountable is us, and that I'm looking at balance of powers and recourse to the public. And I will have that ready by the next time we hear that.
Right.
Or hear this book. So.
Okay. Any questions? Well, thank you.
Thank you,
Mr. Thanks very much.
And we'll, is there anybody in the audience that wants to testify? If not, we have four people online that are still there. Are they still online? Anchorage, we'll start with Michael McLeod. Are you there? Yeah, state your name and your affiliation and your...
Hi, thank you very much. My name's Michael McLeod Ball. I'm the executive director of the Alaska Civil Liberties Union. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee for allowing me to make this brief presentation.
Thank you.
Please accept our statement in opposition to the bill. We oppose HB 117 on the grounds that it will have a chilling effect on the ability of parties acting in the public interest to challenge the inappropriate exercise of governmental authority. Further, the bill will tend to widen the legal advantage currently held by governmental litigants over private individuals. The typical plaintiff in a public interest lawsuit is an individual, a nonprofit advocacy organization, or a charitable organization. The typical defendant in such a suit is a governmental entity, usually the federal or state government, due to the nature of the issues commonly litigated. There can be no dispute that the typical suit pits a party with limited financial resources who needs to hire outside counsel against a governmental entity with access to substantially greater financial and legal resources. As often as not, the dispute is over principle and not over money. Compare this to any other type of litigation. First, private suits almost always involve a fight over money or property interests. Typically, general civil litigation pits business against business, individual against individual. Certainly, there are disparities in each party's ability to cope with the cost of litigation, but it's a matter of happenstance. The public interest litigant, therefore, is financially disadvantaged and typically does not have the prospective benefit of a money damages award. As a result, attorneys are not readily available to take on such cases without sizable retainers. It's simply not profitable for those attorneys to do so. Therefore, the public interest litigant is legally disadvantaged as well because the governmental adversary will always have counsel on board from the start. In his letter of transmittal, the governor complains that the public interest litigant is being subsidized by the current system of attorney fee reimbursement. But bear in mind that the public interest litigant only receives reimbursement if, one, he or she is acting in the public interest, and two, he or she is successful in showing that the government acted wrongly. On the other hand, the government gets its subsidy from the taxpayers whether it wins or not. It's not as if the individual within the government who caused the government to violate the victim's rights, for example, is made to reimburse the taxpayers for the internal costs of running the government in a manner that violates the public interest. The key is to set up a system that does not reward improper behavior, and there will be no incentive for the government to stop inappropriate action if there is no one willing to speak out against such action through public interest legal action. Who will this bill affect? It will affect those in our society least able to afford it. The poor, the uneducated, the minorities, the disabled, the elderly, all of whom have benefited from public interest litigation at one time or another, and many of whom would not have been able to bring such actions in their own right. It won't make a difference to the wealthy individual who funds a public interest lawsuit. For such individuals, attorney fee reimbursement is not a consideration. Rather, this law will discourage normal, everyday people from trying to make a difference when they see the government failing to do its job. If this bill becomes law, the state government will be able to rest easier that it can act against the public interest because it will be less likely to be held to account for its wrongful actions. In short, this bill is presented as if the government is unfairly required to pay for a vengeful individual's lawsuit against the state. Nothing could be further from the truth. This bill will make it harder for someone acting in the public interest to force the government to comply with its legal obligations. And so we strongly urge you to reject this bill. I thank you very much for this time, and I'm happy to answer any questions you may have.
Okay. It sounds like a written statement. If you have that written, can you send it down to us so we can look at it?
It is, Mr. Chairman. I'll give it to the folks here and have them fax it down.
Thank you. Questions? I have one. Is, you know, what happens if the state wins? Do you reimburse the state fully for its cost of, you know, it is state money? If I'm not saying you are, if a public interest, do they reimburse the state, or are they held at?
Mr. Chairman, I will defer to the lawyers on the panel that may know better. My understanding is that public interest litigants do not have to compensate the other side for attorney's fees. However, I think if there is an egregious, frivolous lawsuit filed, there's always that provision that's available to the courts to impose.
Okay, that's kind of interesting. One side pays, the other doesn't. Okay. Hearing no other questions here, we thank you. In Anchorage again, Karen Breitz? Breitz?
Breitz.
Name and affiliation, please.
My name's Karen Breitz. I'm an attorney in private practice, and I'm also the secretary treasurer of an organization called Alaskans for Efficient Government. Thank you for allowing me to speak this morning. I am here to speak in opposition to HB 117. I can say from my experience as an attorney that many organizations and individuals which claim public interest litigant status lack the resources to pay for their own attorney's fees in this type of litigation. And by definition, the public interest litigant has no or very little financial incentive to bring the suit. So the funds just aren't there to be able to pay their attorney the full attorney's fee. In contrast, the government bodies against which they bring suit have unlimited resources and have the ability to make the litigation very time-consuming and expensive. They have, in essence, the power to squeeze the public interest litigant to abandon the litigation or to not even bring it from the start. Attorneys will take on public interest litigation suits with the understanding that if their client wins, that the attorney will be able to be reimbursed 100% of his fees. But without the public interest litigant rule, it's far from certain that the attorney will be able to recover attorney's fees, his full attorney's fees, because the public interest litigant just doesn't have the resources to pay it. The current public interest litigation law puts the public interest litigant on a more even playing field than what HB 117 proposes. And I believe that changing the current law will prevent many worthy lawsuits from seeing the light of day. Thank you. If you have any questions, I'd be glad to answer them.
Thank you. Any questions? I'll ask the same one. If you lose, do you pay the state for any losses or any, you know, for their attorney fees? Or your client?
I can't hear you very clearly, Mr. Chairman, but I believe that your question is if the public interest litigant loses, is he responsible for the government body's attorney fees?
Right, the state's, yes.
No, the public, under the current law, the public interest litigant does not have to pay the government's attorney's fees, excuse me, unless the court makes a finding that the litigation is frivolous.
How often does that happen?
I would imagine that that happens very seldomly. Many attorneys will not take on frivolous litigation.
Okay. Representative
Mr. Olson. Kennedy, to your knowledge, has this ever happened?
To the best of my knowledge, it's never happened where the public interest litigant has paid the government body's attorney fees in public interest litigation.
Well, okay. Thanks.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Now we go to Uwe, was it Kalenka?
It's Uwe Kalenka.
I was not even close, was I?
No, but that's okay.
Okay, your name and affiliation.
Yeah, my name is Uwe Kalenka. I'm president for Alaskans for Efficient Government. I don't have very much to say except second what already has been said. It has been said rather eloquently, and my predecessors have rather well elaborated on it. All I have to say is that $600,000 a year spent on attorney fees is a small price to pay for justice. If we really need to save some money, let's start on a jet that costs $1.4 million so we can finance this litigation for 3 years to help the underprivileged in our society. That's basically all I have to say. We are dead set against this bill, and therefore we are in opposition. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? Hearing none, thank you. Next one is Ken Jacobus in Anchorage. Are you there, Ken?
Yes, I am. I won't repeat what was said except to state that I agree with that. The point that I'd like to make is that in our system, we have a system of checks and balances. The legislatures and the municipal assemblies enact the laws. The courts review the laws. The courts can't go out to themselves and say, a law is bad, we have to review it. They have to have a plaintiff. So what happens is somebody who's dissatisfied, who sees a wrong being done, actually steps up to the plate and says, I'm going to try to protect the public interest by getting the courts to review this bad law. Most of these people, literally 99% of these people are in it for principle. Most of them that I represent don't have the money to carry this forward. The whole idea of public interest litigation is to encourage this checks and balances system to be exercised. You don't put the person who steps up to the plate at risk for losing a lot of money if the taxpayers beat to the person. But on the other hand, you allow the person a financial ability to take the case forward. And as Louis Kalinka says, in order to get justice. Most of the people that I represent are initiative petitioners. I represent these people who need to protect their right of initiative. What's been happening over the last couple of years is they file an initiative. The initiative is rejected by the government. They have to go to court even to get it on the ballot, much less trying to collect signatures and trying to get the matter enacted. The most recent one was the Matanuska Valley tax cap. We had to take that to court. The court held about a month ago that it would go on the ballot, but it was wrongfully rejected by the municipal clerk's office. But those people that sponsor things like that, which are tend to limit government, normally don't have money. They need the right of these public interest attorneys' fees in order to finance their litigation, and as Uwe says again, get justice. The final point I'd like to make is that this particular piece of litigation, House Bill 117, is even worse than the previous. It harms the public interest litigants even more than the previous bill, which two superior courts have held were constitutionally improper. The Nunapichuk case is up before the Supreme Court. What I would suggest on this is don't enact House Bill 117 or anything similar to it, because what this simply does is creates further problems in an area which is already before the Alaska Supreme Court. House Bill 117 is a bad idea, but at the very least, you know, let the Supreme Court rule on the Nunapichuk case before anything more is done in this public interest attorney's fees litigation area. This has been something which has worked well ever since the doctrine was adopted by the Alaska Supreme Court many years ago, and it should be continued, but don't mess it up further. I'll let the Supreme Court take a look at it right now as it's doing. Thank you for listening to me. If you have any questions, I'll be happy to answer them.
Any questions? No questions here. Thank you, Ken. We're going to go to Kenai for Dale Bundren. Are you there?
Dale Bondurant, and I oppose...
Your name and affiliation, please.
Okay, my name is Dale Bondurant, the Alaska Constitutional Legal Defense Fund. That's who I'm representing.
Okay, thank you. Go ahead.
The Alaska Constitution is without a doubt the best constitution of any state in our union. Article 1, Section 1 of the inherent right provision of the Alaska Constitution states that all persons have corresponding obligation to the people and to the state. Our organization, the Alaska Constitutional Legal Defense Fund, is a public interest litigant which has been successful in all our cases before the Alaska Supreme Court. We have never lost a Alaska case as a public interest litigant. I'm going down through these cases. The Peyton case decision found that uses rather than users were more proper and important as applied to public trust resources. The McDowell case decision was stated that fish as a common use resource and a simple one as that. The Gulkana River decision broadened the navigability of Alaska rivers and therefore of all waters in Alaska. The Totemoff case decision was most important in that the U.S. Supreme Court refused to override the Alaska Supreme Court's decision. The OSHEC decision ruled that fish and game guides are as close to the actual harvest of common property resources as therefore fall under the protection of the common property resources. We also find that the 14th Amendment of the Constitution, that those who are elected or selected, i.e. governors, support those who are willing to act responsible interest litigants. We therefore request that those who are selected, including the governor and selection, or and legislatures, and the general public be supportive of Alaska's Constitution and the 14th Amendment. We find that, in fact, proposing changes to both the Alaska Constitution and the U.S. Constitution without proper citizenship's right to vote on such important issues are denied. That's about all I have, but I sure do oppose HB 117. Thank you.
Thank you, Dale. Any questions from the committee? Seeing none, thank you, and have a nice day up there. Anybody else in line? Not at the moment. We do have an interest in the committee room here, so come up, state your name and your affiliation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Kathy Wasserman from the Alaska Municipal League. I'm sure the last five people that spoke certainly have more knowledge of legal issues than I, and I'm not going to even pretend that I have much knowledge of legal issues. But speaking for the municipalities, I just would like the committee to remember that municipalities are also within this bill of 117, and I noticed two of the people that just spoke said that municipalities have unlimited means to fight lawsuits, and I would say two-thirds of the municipalities within the state of Alaska do not even have attorneys and do not have the money to keep an attorney for anything unless something comes up, and any sort of a lawsuit would also harm the public interest of the people in those communities. Thank you, sir.
Questions? Representative Sista.
Thank you very much. My question would be, how many, have you done any study of how many local governments have been sued and comparing that to maybe the state government?
I've never, Representative Sisna, through the chair, I've never really ever had the reason to look at that, but just being in local government for many, many years, I know we've all got stories. My community was sued a couple of times, and it was very difficult for us to be able to protect ourselves. Was it done in the public interest? I don't think so. And there's some that are. I understand that. So I would assume this is a difficult thing to go through. I just wanted to put my own viewpoint on this as well.
Representative Sista, follow-up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess, Mr. Chair, my question would be both to you and to the chair, and that is, would it be possible to maybe find out what experience the local governments have in this, because and to compare it percentage-wise to the state, because if in fact the process works and we're looking at disincentives for maybe those governments that aren't paying attention to constitutional rights and not paying attention to constituent wishes, would actually be that the present law would sort of ferret that out, and it would give us an indication of whether we need to fix things.
Yes, and through the chair, I understand the last five speakers have excellent points, and I certainly would never advocate taking away the ability for people to bring any sort of action against wrongful things done in their communities. I'm not advocating that at all, but just keep in mind that the municipalities in this state, for the most part, have a very difficult time just keeping the power on, and hiring an attorney is, or having to utilize an attorney through a lawsuit is, could be devastating.
Representative
Ms. Wasserman,
yes.
Tom Bedeker still ahead of your legal committee?
Legislative committee. Yes, sir. Yes, he is.
I wonder if you could contact Tom on behalf
of the I will call Tom when I get back to the office, sir.
Thank you very much.
Okay, Representative Ledoux.
Just to follow up on that line of questioning, so would you be able to find out for us of the municipalities that, let's say, have been sued within the last 5 years and have not been, have been the losers in the litigation, how much they paid out in enhanced attorney's fees above what they would have paid out with just regular Rule 82 attorney's fees?
Representative Ledoux.
Communities, those might be.
Representative Ledoux, through the chair, I'll make those calls when I get back and see. And again, I think Tom Bedeker will be very helpful in this. Thank you.
Thank you, Kathy.
Thank you.
Any more public testimony here in general? None online? We're adjourned for the day. Thank you all.